now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, İlkay Gündoğan inspires Manchester City to victory in the FA Cup final. But what's next for Erik ten Hag and Manchester United? Karim Benzema is leaving Real Madrid after 14 years. Will Harry Kane leave Spurs and become his replacement? And will Ange Postecoglou be arriving at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium as their new manager? Matt Dickinson joins us to discuss Manchester United in 1999 and his interview with the former United striker Brian McClair. And Alison will tell us about her meetings with the Brentford boss Thomas Frank and Sport Republic, the owners of Southampton. This is The Game. Hello, welcome back to The Game Podcast with myself, Hugh Wisencroft, alongside Tony Cascarino, Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson, and joining us to reflect on the FA Cup final, of course, our Manchester correspondent, Paul Hurst. If you missed it this weekend, how could you possibly have missed it this weekend? I'm looking at our producer, Scott, who said he was on the golf course. Unbelievable scenes. Manchester City completing part two of the treble with victory over Manchester United in the FA Cup final at Wembley. They lift the trophy for the seventh time. Captain İlkay Gündoğan, the match winner, scoring twice, assuring his place in history with the fastest goal in FA Cup final history. Great goal after just 12 seconds. Now only Inter Milan stand in the way of them and the treble by adding the Champions League to the FA Cup and League Cup they won this season. Paul Hurst, you were there. I was there towards the Manchester United end, shall we say. Neutral, of course, on the podcast. It was the perfect start. I actually said to my mate sitting beside me, as Manchester City kicked off, imagine if they scored straight away. And we managed to get about 3 seconds of giggling in before the ball hit the back of the net.
Prophetic, really, from you, wasn't it? Very
pathetic or prophetic, or both?
Prophetic. I said the same to Johnny Northcroft, who was at the side of me. I said, if City score early here, it could be, you know, it could be a bloodbath. You know, I thought that's, obviously that didn't transpire, but yeah, it was, you know, incredibly early. I predictably had my head down when he scored, so I completely missed it because I was writing the teams out in the formations. But yeah, it was a fantastic goal, wasn't it? Just a brilliant strike, brilliant technique. And he just kind of summed up Gündoğan and his contribution to City this season, particularly in the last third of the season. He's been remarkable. Kyle Walker was saying to us in the press conference the other week that Gündoğan becomes like a prime Zidane at this time of the year. And he scored so many vital goals for City. And he played so well in the middle of the park as well. He was just a... It's a complete all-round performance, and I think it just showed the massive gap between United and City in terms of the quality that they've got in midfield. And, you know, if you're Cheeky McGeary stand watching that, the director of football, you'd be thinking, right, that's probably another 10 grand I've got to put on his wage for the new contract, but whatever he wants, I give it to him because he's just such a huge player for City on and off the pitch.
We'll come back to Gundogan's talents and that contract in a while, but let's dissect the game, gang, shall we, to begin with. Paul's got it right about the start of the game, the impact of Gundogan, but Tony, what were your thoughts watching Manchester United go a goal down after 12, 13 seconds?
Well, like most other people were thinking, well, that's about as bad as it's going to get, you know, for a start for United, and then expecting more from City. I'm disappointed. I find it hard watching Manchester United with offering very little going forward, you know, and thinking, you know, when you do the ratings and sometimes you look at players and you mark them and you start going through the team and you think, well, what would you give Fred? 5, 6? Well, okay. Then you go Eriksen, definite 5. His form's alarmingly dropped off. Casemiro, 6. not bad. Sancho, poor, 5, right? And I kept thinking in my head, the midfield is just weighted so heavy in favour of City. They were just dominating that area. And I was surprised that City didn't add to it. I think most people would have expected 3 or 4. I did. It's just strange. I find it, the whole idea of this improvement at Man United has come from, they are a more dogged team and they do stop you. And yes, they won the Premier League game in this season against Man City. But generally, there was just a gulf of difference, the massive difference between the two teams in quality. You know, Eriksen's the best footballer in midfield for Man United and he couldn't lay a glove on anything. He couldn't seem to get hold of the ball. And he's a fabulous footballer. And that's what City are doing to you, making you look even... I mean, look, the work rate at City was exceptional. And that's without all their talent.
Alison?
Well, I would just like to point out that the only really beautiful pass Man United produced did come from the boot of Eriksen. So it wasn't a complete unmitigated disaster.
I forgot. Christian Eriksen's one of your boys. I totally forgot, actually.
And I did hope, once he'd made that pass, that maybe he might feel confident enough to shine. But Tony's spot on. City suffocate you. So if you do have anything creative in you, it's a struggle to get it out there for a start. I mean, it wasn't an unmitigated disaster in terms of, I don't think you would leave that as a United player and think, you'd think, yes, we were outclassed, and they were outclassed, but there were periods where they put in some graft and some effort, and there were glimpses of confidence as well. And there were just little passages of play where you thought they might sneak something here. But it was in little spurts, whereas City did it the first second, literally, to the last. And I think that's probably what defines their season as a whole, is the way they played in this final, which is their dipping off isn't like any other team's dipping off. When they dip off, they look excellent. And when they're not dipping off, they look pretty unmatchable, really. And that level of commitment. Because I've seen City play in finals and thought, well, I don't think they're that bothered, actually. It's not their priority. They've done this before. But because it's a treble, perhaps, because it was the first Manchester derby as an FA Cup final, they were up for it. And honestly, even though they've been winning silverware with alarming regularity, they looked like they wanted it more, really, throughout, apart from those little spurts of energy and so on from Man United. So I don't know, I can't imagine anyone sitting here and they were surprised how it unfolded. Perhaps Hirsty, you are the most surprised, because you thought it was going to be a bloodbath, as you put it, if City got an early goal, and the fact that it wasn't was probably the biggest surprise of all.
Yeah, and that's it, isn't it? A win, it's not a win, but a decent outcome for United was that it wasn't a bloodbath. Yeah. You know, that it was sort of like damage limitation, wasn't it? To be fair to United, the last 15 minutes of the first half, they played quite well. And when Garnacho came on, he was brilliant. He seemed to take United up another level. But I think the big problem, again, that was underlying for me was that David De Gea, he's just not the answer, is he? He just can't. His passing ability just doesn't suit what Ten Hag wants. If Ten Hag wants, like, his ultimate aim will be to have United playing in City style, you know, passing it out from the back and moving the ball quickly, etc. But when he passes it out from the back, everyone in the United defence and everyone inside Old Trafford just freezes, because they're so worried that there's going to be a mess up somewhere along the line, whether that's a bad pass from De Gea or a miscontrol from a defender. So on Saturday, he was just booting it long. Like, he's booting it long to Marcus Rashford, who's not a target man, and that's not his job. And he's coming up against Ruben Dias, who will win 95% of headers. So as soon as United launch it long, City are back in possession again. I just don't see how that's a long-term plan. It's not feasible, is it, long-term? And I asked Ten Hag about that after. I said, does De Gea have to work on his kicking if you want to play how you want to play? And he said, well, there are certain things that we must improve on next season, which I thought was quite kind of cryptic. You know, he's saying, yeah, basically. So as much as he has been a decent shot stopper for United this season, he's saved him a lot of points, he's just not good enough with the ball at his feet. And if that's how Ten Hag wants United to play, then he just doesn't fit, does he?
Well, who's perfect for United is David Raya from Brentford. Mm. Oh, he would revolutionise them, I think.
Yeah, and now, he's very good, very controlled, very calm and composed. And I was just looking at the Man City backup keeper, Ortega. He's the same as Edison. He's really calm on the ball, really good at passing. Just think he'd be better at United's net than De Gea. And that kind of sums up just where they're at with De Gea at the moment.
Who's the third keeper, Paul? Casey's good enough as well.
Scott Carson. You know. He's a Champions League winner.
I do think, you know, the two teams were, you know, it's a mismatch in midfield, of course. There's two forward lines. I mean, to be honest, people would say Jack Grealish wasn't in the game as much as he has been recently. Erling Haaland wasn't really either. It doesn't really matter when Man United's forward line weren't in the game at all. Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford. I mean, people left that game asking if he was injured for the whole match because he was just, you know, was absent throughout the game. I know Man United had injuries from Antony and Anthony Martial going into the game, but it was a very weird game to watch because you mentioned that the periods that Man United had where they looked kind of comfortable, if not solid, in the game, but they never threatened enough. And after the first goal went in, you always felt City would find something different. I know Ten Hag spoke about, you know, the two goals that we conceded weren't good enough, and that kind of cost us the game. Obviously, two volleys from outside the box isn't really what you want to be conceding, but I do think he has a responsibility to motivate the team in the right moments. And for me, Man United clearly didn't start the game well enough, but just weren't on it in second one, in minute one, and Manchester City were. And at the start of the second half, after Man United had equalised and they came back out, you felt like, again, in that period, Manchester City were switched on, focused, concentrated, and that's when they get the second goal. Man United just aren't, and there is talent, fair enough, there's a difference in talent, but I also think at times now Ten Hag's general demeanour isn't working for the group of players that he has, because they're not self-starters, as we know from most of their time at the club. So he has to motivate them in a different way, and they've lacked that energy and tenacity in large periods of the season. They are beginning to embody him. They're calm at times, and that's exactly what you want them to be. They don't panic at times, and that's helped them get results. But equally, there's no dynamism when they need it, and more has to come from him, I think.
I still think you have to kind of recognise the opponent. Like, you have to give City the credit, the lion's share of the credit for... Alison used the word suffocate. It's suffocating them with and without the ball, because when United do win the ball back, as you said, those periods when they had it, it looked like they were just trying to hold on to it, and very little purpose. Rashford was so isolated. And we know that Ten Hag wants to evolve the way the team plays. Like, I think he's making sort of... He's not playing in exactly the way he wants to play. We saw at the start of the season, and it was, he doesn't have the players ready to do it, and we still see from De Gea at the back that's going to be a big problem going forward. But I think you have to give City the credit. You can't... They don't have a moment's peace when the opposition have the ball, and then when they have the ball, they play with such purpose and pace that it's just kind of disorientating to play against.
I give City credit for winning the game, because I don't think Man United were good enough to win that football match, and I'm not saying that City were at their brilliant best to win it. As we pointed out, they didn't have to be. But I do think if City aren't at their best, a team that has spent as much money in the last 6-7 years as Man United should have had a squad capable, in my opinion. They obviously don't. You need to look at the reasons for that. But equally, I think when you're looking at the team on the day and what Manchester United offered or didn't offer, at times it's too easy to keep saying the Glazers, too easy to keep saying Woodward or the lack of recruitment. I get it. Manchester United squad, you know, isn't good enough, but a poor Manchester City is not unbeatable. I don't know if they fell into the category of poor or just good but not great, but, you know, they didn't create a raft of clear goal-scoring opportunities like we probably would have expected. So mostly that's a chance to capitalise. Manchester United didn't create any. You know, really, the penalty was very, very fortunate, and they probably shouldn't have scored from open play. I can't remember another great chance that they had. Rashford kind of flicked a soft header wide in the first half. It wasn't a great chance, but, you know, maybe he could have done better with it, but there was nothing else. And ultimately, Ten Hag's been with them for a whole year. They've got into the Champions League. They've already won a cup. Where's the threat? You know, and ultimately... Hirsty, I'll come back to you on this, but fans have been talking throughout the year about, you know, Man United are a team getting results, but they're not an exciting team. They need to add another dimension.
I still think it's been a successful season for United. I don't think you know, I think most people would accept that, you know, this, how many points did they get last season? Was it 58 or 59, something like that? They were in absolute shambles last year. So finishing third this year is, you know, that's a sign of progress and winning a trophy. And as Gregor said, this is a Man City team that are, at the moment, they are playing, you know, certainly the confidence levels are as high as they've ever been since Pep got here. So that says something when you've got the quality that they've got in that team. So it's so easy to kind of hammer United at the moment, but Ten Hag's fight with one hand behind his back, isn't it, with the players that he's got. And like Gregor said, he's had to be kind of pragmatic with his approach to the game because he knows he's not got the players who can play that football. This summer is a huge summer for them.
Yeah.
And this is why the takeover is hindering everything. You know, it's dragging on Ten Hag. I was speaking to one of my contacts yesterday or on Saturday, and he was saying that Ten Hag is not happy with the lack of clarity when it comes to how much money he's got to spend this summer and when the takeover might go through and what kind of impact that will have. So that's a concern, isn't it?
And do you know what kind of answers he's getting on that?
But not very clear ones, which is why he's like thinking, well, you know, you look at what they need this summer. They need two strikers, don't they? Two strikers, central midfielder, and maybe a centre half and a goalkeeper. That's a lot, isn't it? It's a lot of, you know, a lot of moving, a lot of kind of negotiations to be getting on with, and they need to get rid of a lot of players as well, and they need to get rid of those players to raise the money to, if they are to buy all those to bring all those signings in. So I could understand why he'd be annoyed at, or frustrated to an extent about what's going on or the lack of movement. Because when the takeover process started, we were told that it would be done by Easter. You know, and now we are, you know, it's still not done. Even if it's completed this week, next week, whoever gets the club, whether it's Ineos or the Qataris, they won't have the keys to Old Trafford for, you know, a couple of months maybe. You know, and that they've got to bring in their own staff, or they've got to decide who they want to bring in and, you know, start talking about transfers, etc. So he threatens to drag on into the summer and affect his plans, and I think that's the last thing that Ten Hag wanted.
Now, you talk about the keys to Old Trafford, but if they do a structural survey like most people do when they're buying somewhere, they'll never get the keys because it'll fail the survey, won't it?
Well, Old Trafford definitely will, because it's got plenty of defects.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's just the whole takeover saga is really kind of overshadowing everything at the moment. I think everyone wants clarity, you know, from the manager to the fans, to the board, etc. So yeah, it's you know, it's something they need to get on with pretty quickly.
Just going back to the football, I think, like, I don't like when you're analysing a club's progress to always revert to, you know, the transfer market. They need better players, but when you look at trying to play possession-based football, which is what we're talking about. You want United to dominate the ball more against the best team in Europe / the world at the moment. And they've got David De Gea, Lindelof, Wan-Bissaka and Fred in that base. You've got no chance. So, like, that does have to change. And then you pan out a little bit and you see where United, as Hirsty's spoken about, where United were and where they are now. You cannot be too down about getting beat by Man City in the FA Cup final. And I know, and even the manner with which they were defeated, because as we've said as well, it could have been worse.
Yeah, no, I'll take like, it. If you're going to lose, I'll take the 2-1, to be perfectly honest.
The progress is clear and they need some key recruits and, you know, in very important positions for them this summer.
Look, you see, if you look at Man City and where they were a decade, and we've seen a lot of improvement. We've seen them win 5 out of the last 6 Premier Leagues. There's an improvement, an upgrade. There's certain qualities you must have, and that is being incredibly good technically, and then you have to have the mentality of being smart. Now, some people say, well, hold it, Jack Grealish isn't the smartest, he's done those things. I'm talking football intelligence. All their players have that in abundance. Now, someone once asked me, I'd had the same record as Teddy Sheringham at Millwall, basically nearly the same. And someone once said to me, what's the difference between Teddy and yourself? Because you both had moves and he ended up doing what he did. And I went, well, Teddy could play for Man United and I couldn't. He had certain qualities that you needed to play for Manchester United. I said, I didn't have them qualities. I had qualities that I could play for other teams, but not Man United. That was the standard.
Is that because you were a Liverpool fan?
What do you mean, was that because I was a Liverpool fan?
You couldn't possibly play for Manchester United,
no,
could you?
Well, apart from that, yeah, well, okay. But I'm talking in...
I think he would have got... I think he would have found a way.
Have I said to Gregor, players that you've played with, could you have played for Manchester United? Do you think you would have had the qualities of what the standard was?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I mean,
come on, Tony. That's a mean question to ask me.
But
no.
Exactly. So,
it's a straight no.
And what you alluded to is spot on, Gregor, that you named players that we know haven't got those qualities. And I could probably even put Sancho in there. I think, and not, he's playing poorly. I know he's playing poorly.
He had
so
a
it's
poor
unfair.
Final.
He's had a poor final, but he's not got the, he hasn't got the qualities that I see of the great wingers of what Man United have had in different ways. I don't see them qualities. I see a player that, yes, he's got technical skills and he's not going to go behind you. Well, then David Beckham never went behind you and Ryan Giggs did. But David Beckham was so good on the ball that that quality was enough to get him in the Man United team.
I do think that kind of points back to some of what we've spoken about already in terms of recruitment. Gregor said you can't always go back to recruitment, but ultimately it reeks of a club that has had no direction for a long period of time. And what you see is, at the end of it, a squad that isn't prepared to go and take on, you know, the biggest clubs in the world, or a squad that isn't worthy of, in the name, I guess, of Manchester United, one of the biggest clubs and histories in the world.
Well, look at City when they lose a player, Fernandinho. Holding midfielder, one of the best around. We'd have all probably said at the time, one of the greatest at doing what he did. Rodri comes in. Why does he come into that position? Because he's got the qualities to play the way that City want to play. So, and you could go through all that team from Bernardo Silva. So he replaced. You know, you think of David Silva left the football club. David Silva gets replaced by Bernardo Silva, who takes his place. And then the list is just endless. You go from fullbacks to wingers to midfielders. And that is what they've done. And United haven't.
John Stones, by the way.
Yeah,
he was outstanding. I know we keep kind of talking about this transformation this year, but there were moments in that towards the end of the second half when United were in the ascendancy, and occasionally there was a little bit of space opened up in midfield, and Stones was the one who snuffed out, either with positional sense or making a long busting run to get back in and make a tackle. His intelligence, as exactly what we've been talking about, is
Gregor,
skill.
The moment in the game, and I was like, oh my God. When he twisted on the 18-yard box.
Yeah.
I was like...
John Stones.
Yeah, John Stones.
Oh, my God.
He just looked over his shoulder. Okay, I can go that way.
No, I tell you what, it was one of those that you really needed to beat at the game, because I was just talking to my mate, I said... Literally 2 minutes in, I went, John Stones is playing number 10 now. I said to my mate, I said, look where John Stones is playing. He picked one up on the edge of the box and smashed it about 15 yards over the bar, and I was in the second half, and I went, well, those are the pitfalls of having John Stones
exactly.
as your number 10. But generally, I mean, he was amazing. I almost feel like John Stones has been unfairly spoken about for kind of two or three seasons. I think he's been one of the best centre-backs in the world for a long time. If you go and cover England and watch England, for example, taking on some of the best strikers around, he hasn't had a problem with that for several years. People always point to errors and stuff that have been made, but I think if you look at the body of work, I remember when, I think I've said it on the podcast before, but I tweeted out when Chelsea was spending 80 million on Fofana and John Stones hadn't been a regular starter for City that season, that I'm sorry, if you've got 80 million to spend on a centre back, you should be buying John Stones. And I actually felt at the time that 80 million might be more than enough to get him out of there. Obviously, they've got a certain approach to recruitment at Chelsea, but I just think, you know, people have not spoken about him until this season. He can do special things as a centre-back. He can do things that most centre-backs can't, but I think even as a conventional 4-4-2 centre-back, Stones is still one of the best out there, you know, even if he stayed at the back alongside Ruben Dias for the whole game. Anyway, very finally, Hirsty, just a quick mention. I know we mentioned him earlier on. Ilkay Gundogan, man of the match. I can't countenance the idea that City would let him go, to be perfectly honest, quibbling over an extra year in his contracts. He has to stay, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think certainly sort of 3 or 4 weeks ago, I would have said he's definitely off to Barcelona. But the more I hear, the more he's giving more consideration to staying at City. I don't think he's necessarily down to kind of, you know, giving the money or the extra year or, you know, it's just about him to sort of deciding where he wants to go in his career, like his career path. And last few weeks have certainly opened his eyes as to, you know, where this team's going. And this could be, you know, this is a potentially treble winning team. And certainly a few weeks ago, I was told that one of the concerns that Gundogan had about Barcelona, despite the fact he loved the city, he spends a lot of time there, and obviously the football club has got great history, is the kind of the mess that they're in terms of their finances, Barcelona, because what he didn't want was to go there and be in the same situation as Christensen was in last year, where I think it was Christensen, I can't remember, there's a few players who turned up on free transfers and they couldn't register them. They were just sort of like in a holding pattern, weren't they? There was kind of, they were free agents, but they'd been told, promised a contract, but they couldn't be registered with the league. And if you're a Ilkay Gundogan, you don't really want to be doing that, do you? You know, you're a player who, potential Champions League winner this time next week, so that entered his mind as well. So that was a factor. But I think City are pushing really hard to try and persuade him to stay. So I think we won't hear anything on it this week, I don't think, not definitively, famous last words. But I think they'll get the Champions League final out of the way, and then we'll find out more for sure. But yeah, certainly City are pushing very, very hard to keep him at the club.
Okay, Paul Hurst, thank you very much for joining us on the Game Podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Just finally, on the FA Cup final, was it a penalty? Alison Rudd.
It was a penalty, but it shouldn't have been a penalty.
I agree. Tony?
It wasn't a penalty. and Peter Walton in the Times today, and I'm not going to give him too much tick, but he says the fans must learn the rules. Peter, it's laws, not rules.
Gregor?
I'm so sick of this.
That's why I wanted to do it very quickly.
It's not, you know, it is by the law, because he's saying it's above shoulder height, yeah, whatever it is. But my God, no, it shouldn't be.
Yeah. By the law, it's a penalty. Shouldn't be a penalty because, and you know, aside from the fact of natural body position, when he turns his head to look, all he sees is Wan-Bissaka's body
going right out
less than a yard away from him. So your instinctive reaction is put your hand up actually to protect your face, yep, from, you know, having your cheekbone smashed to pieces, and the ball ends up hitting his fingers. It shouldn't be a penalty. Letter of the law, it's a penalty. Easy to wrap that one up. We're not going to go into it anymore. It is an episode of the Game Podcast laden with guests, because we're going to continue talking a little bit more about Manchester United, funnily enough, with our very own Matt Dickinson. Matt, long time no see. How are you?
I'm good. Have you recovered from Saturday?
Well, this podcast is very cathartic at the moment. I'm currently getting it out of the system as much as I possibly can, which is maybe why we've taken a slightly Manchester United based tilt, but there you go. Matt, you've done the same, really. You've met a Manchester United legend, in my eyes, a bit of a train tour with a certain Brian McClair. Tell us more.
Yeah, train foot. It's not often you find yourself walking through sort of council estates in Airdrie in any circumstance, but least of all with a legend of Man United, Brian McClair. I mean, in short, we're keen to sit down with him because he's an interesting guy. He's got obviously a long history with Man United, not just as a player who was, you know, integral to the building of the Ferguson era, but also then as academy coach. And, you know, in his views, you know, he sees the dismantling of all that happened under Ferguson with great dismay and sadness. Doesn't think a lot of that was necessary. In the piece, pinned a fair chunk of that on Ed Woodward, you know, and talk to him about that, talk to him about parallels of the rebuild now, what Ten Hag's doing, which he thinks is, you know, largely excellent, but also needs, you know, the big stimulus of big money signings and his concern that the ongoing takeover is going to cause complications with that. But yeah, that was the football side. There was also the, tour foot walking around Airdrie going, you know, literally, a man with a difference, basically, a man who's willing to just spend time with you and talk about football life while having a couple of pints at the Tenants in a pub that, let's just say, he as we walked in, he said, "I'd better order." And I think that was probably wise. he was a bit worried about my Sassenach accent might cause some trouble.
What's he like generally as a person? I think most people that haven't seen Brian McClair for a number of years wouldn't recognise him walking down the street. You know, he's a unique character, if you like, in terms of professional football, particularly when we look at it through the eyes of Manchester United, a club of that stature. So many of their players we still see and hear in the public eye and stuff like that. He has been quiet for most of the time since he's retired, especially given what he did as a player.
He has, which I think is a real shame and a waste of talent, of a guy who's willing to swim against the tide. I mean, you say, partly in looks. I mean, he's got He's gone sort of full Billy Connolly with a twist in terms of, you know, hair, beard. I mean, he sort of rolls his eyes when it's brought up now, as if, you know, man grows very long beard and grows his hair out. You know, he said it appeared in Corriere della Sport in Italy, and he's like, you know, I won a few medals, played 20 years of international football. He wasn't sure he ever made the Italian sports press. He grows a big shaggy beard and suddenly he's in the headlines. But he rolled his eyes and said, that's modern social media for you. But the thing I loved about him is that he is a guy who's willing to challenge the orthodoxy. You know, that's what he did at United. He talked fascinatingly, I thought, about the fact that when he was running the academy, he ordered the players, no back chat. If you foul a player, pick him up. He just said this, you know, and partly because he thought, why waste time being distracted? Why waste time chasing after referees? Get on with your job. But also he said it actually started to win them decisions. You know, referees are sick of being harassed and harangued. And there's a self-interest in actually being polite and getting on with them. So, you know, I said, doesn't sound like an Alex Ferguson way of playing to me, but he said, well, that was nothing to do with Fergie. I decided to do it for myself. And so he's a guy who's just willing to challenge the orthodoxy. And I think certainly at United, that type of thinking is what they've desperately lacked for the last decade.
Attention when it comes to, I think, both Manchester City and Manchester United is all about the treble now. I think if you're a United fan, you're buying an Inter shirt this week. You're practicing your Italian because on Saturday you will be one of the biggest Inter fans in the world. Of course, 1999, we know that you've spoken to so many of those involved in Manchester United's treble, the likes of Teddy Sheringham, for example, and treble envy. And I know you wrote about it in the Times. You've also written, of course, a book. So congratulations. Football Writers Award of the Year, the Jeff Neal Football Book of the Year, 1999, Manchester United, the treble, and all that. But just tell us what the lads of 99 think when they compare themselves with the Manchester City of 2023.
Yeah, it was interesting to sort of catch up with them. And I guess above all, I was surprised that their certain sort of generosity of spirit, I guess, you know, I mean, Gary Neville was among those I spoke to. And, you know, Gary being Gary, obviously, you know, absolutely sort of united to the bones, is, you know, still praying that City trip up. But actually there was a generosity of spirit that if any team is going to join them on this pedestal, it probably should be this one. You know, we talked about Liverpool over the last couple of years, whether they could do a treble, but I think there was a sense of, if it is going to be De Bruyne and Haaland and Bernardo Silva and Pep Guardiola joining them up there among the legends, then sort of fair enough that both teams would be sort of, you know, flattered by some of the comparisons and very happy with those comparisons, because you're talking, you know, a team that was first there and did it in such an extraordinary way with a team which, you know, arguably has sort of become as unstoppable as any we've seen in English football. So, I think they were, say, you know, still... Everyone likes, you know, I guess if you make history, you always like to be unique. You like to be special. But I think that, you know, they're pretty content in the sense that they did it first. And, you know, I would contend, not least having, as you say, written a book out in paperback, available in all the bookshops, you know, they did it in a way that can't possibly be matched. I mean, it's just not, you know, you couldn't recreate the circumstances of that if football's played another 100 years. You know, City are doing it their own way. It's a very different way. It feels very different to me. You know, there's a certain sort of, it feels inevitable, doesn't it? You know, there's still jeopardy, it's still strain, still challenge. But United were sort of exploring the frontiers of what was possible. And there was a sort of unbelievable chaos to that, which made it absolutely compelling.
Matt, I was going to ask you, because I spoke to Dwight York over the weekend, and Dwight was coming from what you were speaking about, saying, look, we done it first. They do it, great, you know, but we done it first and it was a great achievement. And I said to Dwight, what about if they win the final against Inter really comfortably? Because then you could make a case where United, as you said, was very chaotic. The semi-final in the FA Cup against Arsenal, and the way they won that trophy, the way they turned it around against Bayern, there was very heroic feats that they did. But if City won and comfortably against Inter, it feels like theirs was a bit of a breeze.
I know, and you know, and you can argue it all ways, can't you? City fans will say yes because this obviously proves, you know, points totals, everything about it. Statistically, City look, you know, a street ahead in the way they've done it. But I, you know, and that there is, people can admire the sort of, you know, if you build comfortably the best team in the world, club team in the world, then there's something to admire about that. But having lived the 99 experience, having, you know, relived it for the book, as you say, there was just something. And I think the key thing about it was true to the character of Ferguson and the team. There was something a bit reckless about them. There was something that just didn't know how to shut up shop in matches. There was something that couldn't control games the way that Pep Guardiola's team there. And say, you can argue that's a flaw, but actually it was what the flaw that made them so unbelievable to watch. It made, you know, made them so unbelievable to relive. You know, you can go back, I've watched that last few minutes of the 99 Nou Camp final, you know, probably 100 times for the book, and I still get goosebumps. You know, I'm not a United fan, but it was just, you knew, as you sort of lurched from stunning comeback to stunning comeback, you knew you were in the grip of something absolutely once in a lifetime, and it was a treat. And as you say, City, I think, probably will win comfortably on Saturday, and that will have its own quality, but I don't think it's half as nail-biting, thrilling, dramatic a quality as United had that time.
We'll maybe debate that on Monday if we need to. Next week, maybe not.
Sounds like it's going to be so boring. We won't bother.
Matt Dickinson, pleasure to talk to you once again. Remember, everyone, the book is called 1999 Manchester United, The Treble and All That, the Football Writer's Jeff Neil Football Book of the Year. So it comes on very good recommendation. Appreciate it, Matt.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Matt.
Right, up next on the Game Podcast, we'll be discussing Karim Benzema, Harry Kane. We'll dive into Southampton and meet Thomas Frank. Stay with us on the Game.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, there were some, I guess, emotional memories made over the weekend when it comes to a couple of big figures in European football. Karim Benzema marking his final Real Madrid appearance with a goal. They drew their last game of the La Liga season at home to Athletic Bilbao, but they did confirm the day previously that Benzema's 14-year stay at the Bernabeu would end, reportedly on his way to Saudi Arabia for €100 million a year. We'll leave that to one side, Alison, okay? He's a Ballon d'Or winning striker, joined in 2009, 648 appearances for Madrid, second only on their all-time list behind Cristiano Ronaldo. He's got 354 goals for the club. Before we talk about who may replace him, which is probably of more interest, we just got to say, Tony, it's semi-retirement, if you like. He was a fantastic centre-forward for the club, and I think Ronaldo's departure meant he finally got some of the attention, maybe some of the credit he deserved.
Yes. Well, he's going to join Live Football, so which it is now, and it's going to be a common theme because more will do it. I saw him as a 17-year-old at Lyon. I'd retired, and I'd heard a lot about him in the youth levels. Went and saw him in his early days at Lyon. If you'd have said to me that he'd end up going to Real Madrid and winning what he did and achieving in the goals and the numbers, I'd have said you were nuts because he was very lazy. There was a clear talent there, but it was a lazy player there as well. Didn't really want to move his backside in games. If it came to him and it was an half chance, he'd more likely finish it. And that stayed with him, even though when he first got to Madrid, there was a lot of criticism towards Benzema.
Yeah.
And he matured. He grew up. And when he grew up, he became a very serious professional footballer. And he did it young enough to have a long career at Real Madrid because he was superb. And there's leading the line one way and there's leading the line in another. He leads that line with everything you could do. You know, he'll make channel runs, he'll drop into midfield, he'll be the springboard for the attacks, he'll be on the end of crosses. He's done all of that, and he's certainly in his sort of late 20s, early 30s. He's been an extraordinary player, and pity to see that he would be going to live football, but what a player he's been.
Yeah, I think Jose Mourinho famously said when he was the Real Madrid coach, he'd basically been allowed to get away with too much as a youngster, and no one had taught him the fundamentals of football because of his speed and his size when he was a kid. And I remember seeing it in the early days at Lyon, and everyone thought, I mean, it's another one that Man United missed out on, but who knows, you know, what would have become had he joined Manchester United. But ultimately, you watched him in those early days and you thought he'll certainly put the ball in the back of the net. But yeah, he didn't have the all-round game. No, I don't think anyone would have seen him turning into the kind of all-round striker that he has. He's been absolutely, absolutely brilliant. But Gregor, the big question on everyone's lips is who's going to replace him, actually, the moment this story came out. We've been debating on the radio the past week the stories of Kane going to Manchester United, haven't we? And as soon as this was announced, I was on the radio, I said, there's no way Harry Kane turns down Real Madrid to stay in England. And we hear all these rumours now, he wants to stay in England, wants to break the Premier League goal-scoring record, doesn't want to move his family, all of that stuff. I'm like, well, that's, if you're going to Manchester City, that's one thing. I can say this, I'm sorry, as a Manchester United fan, currently there is absolutely no way you turn down joining that Real Madrid squad for a place at Manchester United. I just don't see it. And that's not me being disrespectful to Manchester United. They just aren't where Real Madrid are as a football club right now.
No, I agree. I kind of do think there might be an element of truth in all the stuff that you're talking about there, all the reasons, like, you know, but want to stay in London, essentially, as well, maybe. And the goal-scoring record, because that's when you've been deprived of silverware for your entire career, that's the big thing. He's going to be he could be a legend at one club. He could be a legend for breaking the Alan Shearer's record, but when the other alternative is Real Madrid, then it's a huge decision to make, because they are the, you know, one of the biggest clubs in the world. Silverware would almost certainly arrive if he went there. It's a huge decision for him, but only Harry Kane knows what the answer is going to be, because I honestly do believe that all those other things we're talking about are significant factors for someone like Harry Kane.
Could he go abroad, come back, play in the Premier League again?
I thought about that too.
I think that's a very real prospect, that he could go, come back and still play in the Premier League and beat the record.
What would his length of contract be? If they said they'd have to pay £100 million for him, you're probably giving him 4 or 5 years at least.
Yeah, and 33. Then,
and then who's going to pay?
No. It's all machinations in my mind, but ultimately, you keep Harry Kane for 2 or 3 seasons, and when the Erling Haaland moment comes, when he finally wants to go to Madrid, you've got one of the best make weights in a transfer deal that you could possibly have. You go, here you go, have Harry Kane, we'll give you 150 million quid on top.
Because he needs two seasons.
He goes to City, breaks the record.
Without injury, he needs 2 seasons to break the record, really.
Yeah.
Because he's a guarantee. So I did that cross my mind as well, Tony. I think he might be able to do both, and he might think that as well. Who knows?
Yeah. Maybe out of solidarity with Gareth Bale, he won't go to Madrid in the end.
look, there's also, he could achieve both goals. He could go and win things for Real Madrid and then come back and get the record in goal scoring.
I think he can. I do think he can. I don't think in his mind he's stopping anytime soon. And he's always going to have that goal scoring ability because it's natural. So for me, you have to go to Real Madrid. But it's just, in my mind, it's kind of, are people going to pay the money? I think Real Madrid, like I say, if they think, can we use him as a make weight in the future for Haaland? Or is there going to be a club in England prepared to pay the thick end of 100 million quid to have him in a few seasons? I think the answer is yes. You know, it might be Newcastle United, might be Man United still. You know, I do think clubs in England are going to be very interested in Harry Kane. Just because he's gone to Real Madrid for 3 seasons is not going to change anything. Even if he isn't a great success at Real Madrid, there's still going to be plenty of suitors in England for Harry Kane. So for me, life experience wise, to go to Madrid, to go to a club of that size, with respect to Spurs, you know, he's been at Spurs for his whole career. It is something going to Spain, another culture, a club of that magnitude.
How,
that, that
how
can...
many of us want to, actually us here, want to see how he fits into a team like Real Madrid? I mean,
I'd love to.
Forget him and his family and his kids. I want to see, I need to see that.
Yeah.
Because it could be amazing.
Yeah.
And if it isn't,
superstar.
It'd be interesting if it isn't, wouldn't it? Yeah. I want to see how it works.
Yeah. And Spurs might prefer for him to go to Madrid more than Man United.
I reckon they would.
They would. Yeah.
So basically, it's a no-brainer from all of us.
Yeah.
All right. And if you wonder why, just listen back to the Man United part where we say the club's basically a shambles and we don't know what's going on this summer. There are a few people that argued this, and I ultimately thought it was nonsense, but you can tell me as a goal scorer, Tony, how much records matter. Because people keep saying, oh, no, he'll stay in England because of the record. He wants the record. And I'm like, there's a guy playing in England at the moment who, if he stays for 10 years, will break that record, probably double it. Mm. You know, so is there any point in really caring about records? Records are made to be broken. Medals, trophies, people can never take away from
you. Yeah, they're lovely, though. And I haven't got many, but I'm the oldest player in French football to get a hat-trick in Ligue 1. Okay? Okay, right. So there's one. I've told you straight out of the bat.
Yeah.
I'm the first player to get Millwall's first goals in the top flight.
Well, they can't take that
now,
away from
now
you.
A lot of people wouldn't know them, but I'm very proud of them. And then you're going to, obviously, there's a scale. There's been a Premier League top goal scorer ever, which is an incredible accolade to achieve. So I would say it would be incredibly important, as it would be for Alan Shearer, who talks about it.
But I do have to say it's kind of a contrived record as well, right? Yeah. I mean, it's the Premier League era. So if they turn
the one you hear most now.
No, I know that. But what happens when the Premier League becomes a super-duper-duper Premier League, supercalifragilistic league?
Yes.
And then it's like, and this guy that you've never heard of scored, you know, and then suddenly it's like, oh, Harry Kane, he was the top scorer when it used to be the Premier League, and Dixie Dean was the, and Alan, like, do you know what I mean? Where it's like, ultimately, the world changes, and your record, disappears.
Mm. Well, you can then be an older man that moans, and someone will say to you, oh, you're just a moany old man.
I'm not sure Harry Kane's thought about it in this much depth, to be honest, guys.
No, but the other question for Kane, though, is how much do you force it now? You know, it's one thing going around the golf course with Gary Neville, having a chat, saying you want to win trophies, but not really saying, I'm desperate to leave this football club. And now, with a year left on your deal, for me personally... I know he won't want to do it. He'll probably forgo a couple of million quid loyalty bonus as well. But you're looking at transfer request territory in my eyes.
It's how desperate he is to leave, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because he could hang around another year and then have any option that he wants. And it's pretty clear that, as Tony said, Spurs don't want to sell to someone in the Premier League. So this could be a kind of a good way out for everyone. But that depends on how desperate he is to leave. He might think, I could do another season and then maybe only have one more season to come back after I go to wherever I go.
He's got the all-time goal scoring record for Tottenham. So that's a fabulous achievement already in the bag. There's others there. If Harry ends up finishing his career one day and not winning anything and not getting the all-time Premier League record, you think something's wrong there, wouldn't you?
But how would he feel?
There's no bigger move, is there? There's no bigger move in world football.
But how would he feel if he left Spurs and then they won a trophy?
And it could happen under Ange.
I've got to say, if he leaves and he doesn't win any trophies, and then Spurs win a trophy, you'll probably feel bad. Yeah. Ange Postecoglou. Very quickly, because it's not been confirmed, and I've got to say, I've been burnt before with Tottenham and managers. All right, we've spoken too much about who might be the next Spurs manager, only for it to transpire that they're not going to be the next Spurs manager. And so, Gregor, I think we can leave the deep dive into Ange Postecoglou for when he does get the job, all right? But generally speaking, the reaction of Celtic fans that I've seen is, what a legend. He completed the treble at the weekend with the victory in the cup final. Ange Postecoglou, who was, you know, in Japan two seasons ago, who has been previously the Australia boss. He's won a couple of A-League titles as well. But, you know, isn't like a young, up-and-coming manager per se. He's 57 years old. So the only thing that I'd say about Postecoglou is he's got a grit and determination about him that
Absolutely. He's
been written off too much and he wants to prove everyone wrong. And, you know, when you're bringing that kind of passion into a club like Tottenham, I think it could be hugely beneficial. His sides do also play very good football as well. All the Celtic fans are basically saying he's a legend. We want him to stay. He's got a fantastic record. He's won 5 out of 6 trophies in Scotland so far. Does he make a big impact if he comes to the Premier League?
I think he makes a big impact on Spurs. That's how big that impact is going to be on the Premier League itself because of the competition. But I think he makes a big impact. Because what he does is he combines two things. He's a fine coach. You've seen that in Celtic's play and sort of intensity and all the things that Spurs want, actually. It's kind of expansive, attack-minded, kind of relentless, intense football. But he's also a manager in the real sense of the word. He's like the face of the football club and he's happy being that. And he's quite kind of, I wouldn't say dour, but he's like straight bat. But he's smart and he'll say things about his responsibility to be something about like embodying the football club as a whole. He knows that a club is more than just a commercial entity, which is what's, you know, the fear has been for Spurs. And you've also got to remember that when he inherited the Celtic team, they were in turmoil. Like, he had to sign 17 players in his first season. They'd lost Scott Brown, who was the captain for a long time, Edward to Palace, Ayer to Brentford. These aren't big names, but they were big players for Celtic.
Yeah.
And they just lost the chance of winning a 10th successive title, which was a huge, huge thing in Glasgow. And the city rivals were ascendant. So there's some parallels here. Like, you've got a team that, you know, they might be about to lose their star. Their rivals across the city are in fine fettle, nearly, you know, challenged to win the Premier League this year. And there's a bit of there was protests going on at Celtic Park as well against, you know, saying sack the board because they'd let this glorious chance slip through. And he was the man who came and kind of grounded everything. He was the face of the football club. He was relentless on the training ground. They had that kind of motto, "We don't stop," and it kind of took off. And he's also different to recent appointments in that he's not going to turn up acting like he's doing Spurs a favour. As you said, this is a huge thing for him.
Yeah.
57, he's never worked in a top 5 European league. This is a big chance.
Former Celtic striker, Tony Cascarino.
Well, I wasn't there very long and a lot of
fans. Oh, he's trying to erase it from history. It's a fact.
Well, I was going to say to Gregor on this that...
It's not a record he wants to hold on to, obviously.
Obviously, without sounding disingenuous in any way, that, you know, their record in Scotland was excellent. Their campaigns in Europe struggled, Champions League.
Yep.
You know, I found it really hard to get even points in the games they played. Because obviously... That record in Scotland is incredible, and you think, well played, and his recruitment was obviously excellent, because if you lose 17 players and you bring a lot in, the majority of them have to work. Otherwise, the club is going to be in freefall. And he managed all that, but then goes to Tottenham, and he's facing some really big problems. Obviously, we've just talked about Kane. We're talking about a club that has lost its direction because it's lost the director of football. They've changed manager. There feels a lot that he's got to do that's going to be even bigger than the challenge at Celtic, to me.
The football side's bigger. But those are all the same issues, and it's all relative, but people in Glasgow feel that they've got the biggest, the most pressurised jobs in world football. And I know they're wrong, but they feel that way, and it's enormous. And there were huge issues there. So, yes, the football thing is... You can see the results of his work in the training ground, absolutely. And you're talking about he's stepping up to a new standard of player as well. So it's whether his work can affect them. And from what I've seen, I believe it could. So it's all, of course it's an unknown. It's like when he came to Celtic, it was an unknown though. Mm. People were saying, who's he?
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing. He's taken a big step in the last 2 years as well. So although this is a big step and no one is discounting that, I think it would be an exciting one for Spurs.
But Spurs chewed and spat out the... two of the biggest, strongest characters in football, in Mourinho and Conte.
I would argue that
I know what you're saying. I know you're saying they acted a bit like they were doing Spurs a favour, but they are both very strong-willed managers who've won through strength of character as much as anything else. They have won.
But they created the acrimony. They created it. So
did they? No, both sides created it because they weren't allowed to do what they were saying. What's the point? They ended up saying, "What's the point of hiring us?" With everything you know about us and our track record and our CV and what you know about our personality, and then just cut it up from under us. That's what they said.
And they were right. But the point is that they didn't marry. They didn't fit with Spurs. They didn't fit with Spurs as a football club. We've been talking about this all season. That's not what Spurs need to be doing. They need to be hiring someone who can develop players, who's almost the same as a Spurs signing. Someone who comes to improve, maybe take the first steps into the Premier League, a lot of these players. It's not proven winners. That's not what Spurs are. So I think there could be quite a good bit of synergy in this.
So does Joe
I'm disappointed too, I have to say that. Like, I'm not saying this like Celtic fans will be distraught about this, because as I say, it was an absolute mess what he inherited 2 years ago.
So does Joe Hart reappear at Spurs? Won the treble?
I doubt it.
No, I don't think
so. But players is the most interesting thing for me, because I think one of the reasons that Spurs have probably been losing out on some of the other names that they've been talking to, if you like, is, you know, what's going to happen with the squad of players that they've got? How many managers are going to be excited with working with, for me, a squad that has a load of duds in? Players who are not cut out to be playing top six football in the Premier League. What happens with all of those? A Tottenham, the kind of club that we've seen over the last 10 years to get 10 players out in a summer and get 10 players in. No, I don't. I mean, the most successful Spurs players this season were all on loan. Clearly, there's a cultural problem at the club. So it has Ange Postecoglou sat down with them and said, you know what, Brian Hill, I can make something out of him. You know, if players coming back off loan, oh, I could do something, you know, because it's not just the players within the squad at this point in time. And then how much money do Spurs need to spend this summer to be competitive in terms of, I reckon, a top four race? I think it's a lot of money at this point in time. And then the other big question, as we mentioned, is what happens with Harry Kane? So in a weird way, I think Postecoglou, seeing the character that he is, to walk into a club like Spurs that are in so much turmoil, I mean, he must have had some incredible answers from Daniel Levy to feel like that's going to help his career, other than maybe a personal feeling that it's now or never. You know, I've got a fantastic opportunity here that I just have to take, and if I can make a success out of it, well, God knows what I'll go on to, because if you make it a success of Spurs right now, then, you know, clearly you're going to be off to a much, you know, a very, very big club. Well,
look, apart from Harry Kane, Hugh, there's some massive decisions to make, and that is, obviously, Hugo Lloris probably has played his last game for Spurs, so there's a move on, there's a new goalkeeper required. Mm-hmm. Then you go, Eric Dier survived every manager, OK? Every manager they've employed, he's survived, and it's been the same story every time. Starts OK, and then they all laud him as this great centre-half and ends up going backwards. Their back line is awful. I would argue that they're one of the poorest defences, and the way they plan, the way they were set up, they were just so easy to play against. And then they have midfield, let alone Bentancur through injury. Not one midfielder with the ability to get on the ball and find passes and create chances. What they've got through is really having Son and mainly Kane that were always going to deliver. After that, you've got a massive job on your hand.
Plus some of the key players, the likes of Kulusevski coming out and saying, I don't really know what's happening with my future. I think I might be going back to Juventus. Yeah. No one's really said anything. You know, all those things need to be clarified. And it's a very tough place to be walking into now, Spurs, without that kind of, you know, that element of aura about you from having loads of success elsewhere. I know it's a weird thing to say, because obviously they've had Conte and Mourinho and the squad seemed unaffected by them, you know, generally. But what does Postecoglou, you know, when he walks through the door, what does he have? What can he say? Other than, this is what I mean, you almost overhaul the squad with players who are on a similar trajectory, up and coming, hungry, want to prove themselves as being top players in the Premier League. That means you overhaul the squad, because you just can't work with the players, most of the players that Tottenham have right now. I just don't see how he can make that work without overhauling the squad. So, and ultimately,
that's a process, though. That has to be it will be a process. They can't do it on one summer. But, and he also has to convince them with the quality of his work as well, I think. I think he had that impact on the Celtic squad. And you're right, he did have that opportunity in the summer to make a lot of changes. And there were a lot of his fingerprints on signings. You know, I think there were five from Japan, one from South Korea. I'm not sure you can do that now in the Premier League. You may actually go back to Celtic for someone like Kyogo. Hope not. But, I don't know whether you can be that kind of all-encompassing, you know, powerful figure at Spurs in the same way he was at Celtic. So that does raise questions, absolutely. But the most important thing is the quality of his work, whether that influences the players, whether he brings them with him, and then whether he's a kind of strong enough public figure for the club. I think the answer could be yes to both of those things.
So what, if I asked all four of us here, I'll give you my opinion quickly, but asked us all and said, if they were mid-table or just below by October, November, would you be surprised if he was sacked?
No,
that's what I mean. For me, I think he's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant coach. Yeah. And we've, you know, for example, we saw Graham Potter turn down jobs previously and say, you know, it needs to be the right club. And then for some reason, he took the Chelsea job. But I think Postecoglou is one of those coaches where you always felt, okay, he's already shown us he's a brilliant coach. He's going to end up leaving Celtic. The one thing I want for him when he leaves is that he goes to the right club. And I actually said at the start of the season that I thought Potter would end the season as Spurs coach and Postecoglou would end the season as Brighton coach. That was one of my predictions at the start of the season. So I thought he would come to a good, stable club in the Premier League.
You were wrong twice.
No, my point was I thought he would move to a club like Brighton.
Yes.
I would say that his links with Brighton are like...
Thanks, Tony.
Should be a feather in his cap too. When you look at who they employed and the fact that Brighton are one of the... You know, a club we've just been pouring our affection over for much of the season. He was in the discussion for this job as well. So like...
So not that wrong. Excellent.
I think...
You sound like we're discussing an injured whippet from Battersea Dogs Home and hoping he gets a nice place to live.
Look, the thing
in
is
the
as well...
Potter, in the country, Potter, with owners that really look after him and give him the right diet.
Potter's not daft. Potter went and asked the right questions, I'm sure, and he was given answers, and it turned out to be absolute nonsense. That's all managers can do.
Yeah.
He'll go, he want the job, he'll look for some...
Reassurances
about certain things, and I'm sure he'll be given them. Whether it actually turns out to be the truth or not is a different matter.
Right, in terms of stable clubs, Alison, we need to have a conversation here. You have sat down with some central figures in the demise of Southampton this season after their relegation from the Premier League. Rasmus Ankersen and Henrik Kraft, the co-owners of Sport Republic, of course. They bought Southampton January of last year with the financial backing of someone else you met, Dragan Solak, Serbian businessman. So what did you learn about the level of remorse, firstly, from those three gentlemen, and also an understanding of what they'd done wrong? Did you get a sense of, you know, them knowing what they've... Well, it was a car crash, basically. I mean, did they understand the magnitude of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was slightly sceptical going into it, thinking, why they don't want to meet me? I mean, are they going to try and soft soap this? I said to the guy in charge of the media before I went in, I said, all I'm looking for is honesty. You have gone down. I mean, things haven't gone well. And he was like, no, they're going to be honest. And it was slightly gobsmackingly honest. They admitted that they had not paid enough attention to what was going on. They thought...
Dominic Raba football.
You could invest and give money. And they did spend money, but they didn't have any sense of a hands-on approach at all. So Dragan Solak, who's the reason they had the money, he's the billionaire, he's the one with the dosh. He didn't create Sport Republic, he was brought in as a... He said himself, I thought I was going to be a silent investor. That hasn't worked, i.e. I've got all the dosh, what have I got to show for it? But he said he'd been to the training ground. Well, I saw him at the training ground, it was his third visit ever to the training ground, and he'd been to a handful of games. And he just thought, this is dreadful. And so because he's the money, the two guys who set up Sport Republic have to agree that they've just not been a presence at the ground. So they're going to have a shared office at the training ground. They've done a complete clear out of... Apparently the executive level was a bit bloated and it was very hard to see who was in charge of what. So they've streamlined it. They're going to be much more hands-on and... They're going to try and blitz it and get straight back into the Premier League by just doing it better. And it does seem to me rather peculiar that you would... I mean, the guys who set up Sport Republic, Henrik and Rasmus, their stated aim is they want to revolutionise football. They think they can do that. They think they can reinvent football, that they can unearth talent specifically from Africa and then put it through the system, the academy system and the youth team system, and then bring it through to a club that will eventually be in the Premier League again, Southampton, and make it all self-sufficient and holistic instead of splashing out money on players that you haven't guided through the process. That's how they think they're going to reinvent football. And Rasmus Ankersen was director of football at Brentford, so he's seen how a team can grow from modest background to one that's doing exceptionally well in the Premier League. They believe it's possible if you think outside the box. But so for them to be that inventive and yet not be there to oversee it was quite a staggering admission. So they said, we did it wrong. We did it completely wrong and we're going to put it right. We're going to be more hands-on, look at who's making the decisions on a day-to-day basis. They didn't really have any contacts with
the managers, it seemed, they'd brought in the young... We've talked a lot on the podcast about there are too many young players with no Premier League experience, and they said they couldn't understand why they didn't have more of an impact, why they didn't integrate into the team. Well, they didn't have an understanding of that because they weren't there to work out how they were being integrated. It was just this massive distance of almost like academically running a football club, and now they realise you can't do that. You have to practically run a football club and be more involved. And so that's their promise to the Southampton fans is... They got it wrong. They're going to put it right.
Did you believe them? Like, because you get a sense when you interview someone, you've interviewed many, of course, when you look into their eyes that they really mean what they're saying. Did you sense it was there were hollow answers, or did you truly believe that they felt they can make that difference?
I believe they found it slightly difficult to admit it, because I felt that the two blokes behind Sport Republic have, it's been slightly humiliating for them. I think they're very clever people. And they got it wrong. And also they're sat in the room with the man without whom they can't do it. He's the billionaire. So, and he's a great character. He's fantastic. He's funny, outspoken. You know, he was saying, like, you know, I love playing golf with Ralph, but we couldn't have him as a manager anymore. He was just like he was just like really outspoken. And they looked slightly uncomfortable at how outspoken and honest he was, but he's, you know, money talks. And so if he's going to continue to back them, they have to be as open as he was, which was, he said, got it completely wrong, didn't I? I can't be a silent investor. I've got to be here. Got to enjoy it. Got to do something.
They have to deliver. You know, any structure, any organisation, I always think back to Marseille, because Bernard Tapie was exactly that crazy guy. You know, he knew what he wanted. He would question everything. He'd say to people in charge of the coaching, like, what are you doing training today? Well, he needs to work on his heading. He'd tell the coach all these things and, you know, just generally. And sometimes it was crazy. You'd come away thinking, get him out. Just get him away from the training ground. But he'd appear. He once pulled up in a limousine on the pitch as we was playing a game, practice game. The limousine opened its doors and he got out and just stopped the match. And the coaches, but boy, did he know his football. He was unbelievable, knowledgeable about the game. I found that out after the year and a half I had with him. His knowledge of the game was exceptional. And it was probably an eye-opener for owners, because so many of them get stick because they don't seemingly don't know enough or don't have a hands-on approach. Yet he had all of that. And look, he won the Champions League. Some people say, Tapie was this or that. But he did produce some incredible teams, and literally what we're talking about, hands on.
It was funny. He was funniest about Nathan Jones, because that was a mistake, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so I obviously asked them how much they regretted that, and Dragon said, "Well, we had no idea what he'd be like when you put the microphone in front of him. I mean, they just didn't know this was going to happen."
Plenty evidence of that as well.
Oh my gosh.
Plenty evidence of that.
This is
I know it's
I mean.
Not in the Premier League, but you can, you know, maybe look outside the Premier League, because that's where you got them from.
Yeah.
Well,
there's so many departures behind the scenes too, though. If you're not there, you also don't know what the environment's like, and it deteriorate really quickly there, I think.
Yeah.
Martin Simmonds has just left as well. He's like the last
last
remnant of what. And then when they arrived, they said, "We want to build on the things that make Southampton good," and what they've done is tear it apart now.
Yeah.
So, like, this is a new club. It's entirely on them. It was on them before, but it's now entirely on them, because they ripped up the scouting department. I think the academy head's left as well. You know, all the board. So, like, it's just them, and it's on them now.
Incredible. You know, like, you look at what's happened at Brighton with Bloom, and we talked about Brentford before. It's all been extraordinary. Then you look at St Gilwell's in Belgium, and Bloom's the owner of that club, and he's got a partner that's hands-on over there. And he was talking about, well, we always look at social media of our players that we're intending to buy. We look at what they're like, what they buy, what they act like. Are they flash? Are they the right suit for this football club? He said his words were, there's just so much evidence to find out what type of character we're buying. And you sort of think, well, yeah, that's taking a bit of time to find out if you're spending 2 million quid or 20 million quid about what someone's like.
He also had, like, a carbon copy of what he's like when it went wrong at Stoke. Like, he was running onto the pitch on the rare occasions he won, and, like, beating his chest and, it's like, you know, slightly unstable looking almost. So, to, you know, if things were to go wrong, then you've got evidence there of what Nathan Jones was like.
I find it remarkable with Southampton. I'm gonna enjoy covering them a lot, of course, on the EFL next season. But it's a huge experiment, which I think, having watched the Championship this season, you know, a lot of those young players who weren't yet ready for the Premier League could be really exciting and fun players to watch in the Championship if they can get things right on the pitch. So I'm very intrigued. You also, Alison, managed to meet someone that I can only describe as one of your favourites. Thomas Frank.
My manager of the season. Yeah.
The Brentford boss, yes. He's told you firstly what it would take for him to leave the GTEC Community Stadium. When we were having this conversation about Ange Postecoglou and Spurs, he was a manager who was immediately in my mind as maybe a safer bet, but maybe he would feel Spurs isn't the right club for him.
Well, I did say to him, because the culture of somewhere is desperately important to him, the culture of where he works, and he's proud that he's contributed to the culture that there is at Brentford. I mean, you won't find anyone, not even Chelsea and Fulham fans, trying to denigrate the culture at Brentford. It's very good culture, very positive, nurturing culture. And so I said, you know, presumably you don't just leave Brentford for something glitzy if you have doubts about the culture. And he said, spot on, I don't. So that sort of rules him out of Spurs, doesn't it? Because you equally won't find anyone who says the culture at Spurs is in any way remotely like it is at Brentford. So, no, but it's always nice to see a manager on their own, not part of a press conference, and it's just one journalist getting the chance. You know, breaking news, we sat on a sofa facing a huge window which overlooks the pitch, so the light was on his face, and he has golden eyes. It was slightly disconcerting because you don't see it unless the light's shining on him. They're sort of golden with a hint of green. Very unusual colour.
James Bond.
it was very disconcerting. And but he's fantastic. But he's a bit unlike any other manager in that I did ask him how ambitious he was, and he did say he was ambitious, and he did admit to having an ego, but equally he wasn't afraid to say, it's a tough job, I might give it all up and go and work with kids. he doesn't mind that he might be seen as someone who isn't that voraciously ambitious. I mean, it's almost like, in some ways it's happened to him accidentally, he just happens to be extremely good at coaching. But he knows it's a tough job that could burn you out.
So do you get the feeling he would look at, say, Conte or Mourinho and go, I don't want to be like that, even with success?
No.
Like he thinks about his answers too, which is more than can be said for some people.
He asks you to clarify.
He's talking about me.
He's worried that his English is fantastic, but he is worried that it's not his first language, so he doesn't want to assume he might have got a nuance wrong. Mm. So he will pin you down when you ask something. He will pin you down on exactly what it means and what's the difference between two adjectives and stuff like that. So he is very thoughtful, but he doesn't say something because he thinks you want to hear that answer. If he doesn't think it's a very good question, he'll sort of shrug and gloss over it a little bit. But if he thinks it's a good question, he'll really dig deep down into what language you're using. Like, we talked for a while about the difference between, and this is probably something to do with Denmark's, the difference between ambition and determination, because he saw them as intertwined. And I was saying, they're not intertwined. You use one to make the other happen. And he's like, oh, okay. Because obviously in Danish, it's slightly different. What definitely one of the more intelligent and emotionally intelligent managers that I've met in my very long career covering Premier League football.
Lovely. So it wasn't a case of never meet your heroes. You were pleased.
Very, and he agrees my pronunciation of Yai Eskadai is perfect.
Lovely. I'm glad you enjoyed meeting Thomas Frank. I would have been very sad if you came back disappointed from that experience. Been a pleasure to be with you once again. Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino, Gregor Robertson, Matt Dickinson, and Paul Hurst as well. Yes, we have a European final between here and the next time we meet. West Ham United taking on Fiorentina in the most important Europa Conference League final ever. We can definitely say that for sure. We, of course, will also look ahead to the Champions League final. Maybe we'll have some confirmation as to new managers at new clubs and transfers taking place, etc. So plenty more juicy stuff ahead of you. And remember, mark your cards. We will be with you throughout the Nations League games and the friendlies this summer when it comes to international football as well. So still a couple more weeks of us on the Game podcast. Remember, in the meantime, make sure you're subscribed. You can hit the notification button. You won't miss an episode. And of course, you can subscribe online, thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you Thursday.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.